Joseph Olson with us, civil engineer, as we talk about climate change. We're going to talk about Earth cycles. We'll get into his thoughts about why he doesn't believe we may have gone to the moon with astronauts. We'll talk about that. And we'll take your calls here on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Joseph Olson. We'll get to your calls this hour as well. Joseph, let's get back into the cycles, of course. Something that you believe in, something that I believe in. What do you think most people would say? Would they believe in cycles of the planet or man-made climate change? What do you think?
A great way to introduce this argument is to go online, pull up global temperatures, 2500 BC to 2040 AD. It's a graph done by Cliff Ferris and Randy Mann, and it shows the cycles. It's very obvious. You have the Minoan warming period, you had the Grecian cooling period, you had the Roman warming period, you had the Dark Ages cooling period, you had the Midi warming period, you had little ice ages. During the little ice ages, the Thames froze 6 foot thick. They had ice festivals where they walked elephants across the Thames.
Well, Joe, it's a baffling thing. Why is it so emotional for people? Why can't they just have dialogue? And, somebody believes something, somebody believes something else, but it almost gets into a fist fight.
We've been in this self-hate by people that rule us. You know, if you can, everybody hate everybody else. You know, if you hate somebody because of skin color, religion, sex, age, education, income level,
Joe, I'm going to stop you for a second. This phone is horrible. I'm going to have Tom call you on your cell phone, so I'm going to hang you up now, and we're going to get back and put you right back on with your cell phone, and we'll do that for the rest of the hour, because wherever you are, maybe sunstorms or blackouts or something are causing you to crackle, crackle, crackle like crazy. So we'll get you right back on, and we're talking with Joseph Olson. He is a civil engineer. He believes that we are in Earth cycles, and he believes, along with Dr. Tim Ball, who's a climatologist who comes on the program quite regularly, about the same thing. And, of course, a couple of his other thoughts that I don't agree with is he believes that we might not have gone to the moon with astronauts. But let's get you back on here, Joe, and see if that's a little better. You with us?
There you go. I can hear you great.
Okay, great. But back to these cycles, and I was asking you why it seems to always end up in a close to a fist fight.
Because they've done everything they can to divide and conquer all of humanity. And so they split us up by, you know, national origin, race, religion, age, sex. I mean, anything they can do to create wedges and fault lines between humanity so that we can't unite and go, you know, we're all brothers on this planet. Let's make this an Eden on Earth. And that's what the people that actually control the major resources of the planet are, have against us. And trust me, they do not want us to be able to figure out what's going on and to be able to unite and make the world that we really certainly deserve to have. I'm ready for the 1,000 years of light, personally. So getting back to this chart by Randy Mann and Cliff Harris, they did ground-penetrating radar in Greenland. And when I was in high school, we were told that the Vikings discovered Iceland and that they had a hard time getting people to move there because of the name. And so when they discovered Greenland, they just used a real estate marketing trick, and they called it Greenland to get people to move over there. Wrong. It was actually way warmer. Using ice ground-penetrating radar, they found stone dairy barns under 6 feet of ice on Greenland that had up to 50 cattle each. And by digging through those barns, they found artifacts that verified Viking occupation during the Minoan, Roman, and medieval warming periods, and no Vikings during the periods when they were cooling. Because over time, your metallurgy, your tools, your weapons, your runes, everything changes over time. So they were able to actually date and say, based on these layers, this layer they had occupation, then they had no occupation. This layer had occupation, no occupation. So what are you going to believe, 100,000 dead Vikings or a bunch of overpaid climatologists?
Let's go to the phones. First-time caller, Chris, truck driving in Ohio. Chris, go ahead, sir.
Hello there, guys.
Hi there.
Jason, you hear me okay?
I could hear you better, but if you could get closer to your phone.
Okay, is that better?
Just a little bit. Go ahead. We can get your question, though.
Sure, yeah. I was listening to a fella on radio the other night. I think his name is Lord Moncton. He goes by Christopher Moncton. He's a one of these climate denier guys. I'm not sure myself. He made a lot of sense, though. But he, he's got a lot of scientific facts behind him by the sounds of it. That this climate stuff's been happening, as early as the 1600s, where he claims the sun, and this group of scientists claim the sun goes through periods of inactivity and activity, and you have these cold decades and then warm decades. But he also said in the UK that there was a father who was a truck driver as well, who was upset with all this climate change indoctrination with his children in school, took the British government to court and won.
Do you know that case at all, Joseph?
Yes, I know Christopher Moncton from the Heartland Convention in Las Vegas, and we've had hundreds of emails over the last 10 years. And we had the three-day face-to-face encounter numerous times over there. I'd be glad to debate him anytime on climate, and I've extended that offer to everybody on both sides of this fake debate. So if you're a warmist or you're a lukewarmist, I'm throwing down the gauntlet. Let's have a debate where everybody can see what's really going on, because I can prove that what you have is a linear, anecdotal, single-parameter hypothesis that cannot be corrected with a coefficient.
Next up, Stephen in Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. I have been listening to you, George, for more than 20 years now. You've robbed so much sleep, but today was actually the first time I ever called you, and God gave me a nudge. He said, call him.
All right. So you're on. You made it.
And guess what? My question is very simple. I love real science. This guy makes sense. Real science can be proven every time the same result. And he's doing, in my opinion, real science. But I believe in God more than I do anything. And I'm just a simple man, and I always like to think about God saying to Job, were you there when I laid the foundations of this world? Nobody was there. But, real science is observable, and it'll give you the same result every time. And God didn't – I don't have a bunch of degrees on the wall, but God gave me common sense. Does this guy believe in God? Because he sounds like he's doing real science.
Well, that's an interesting question, because he has his own thoughts on the Big Bang. Joseph, take it away.
When you look at this universe, and it is extremely complex and extremely ordered from the subatomic all the way out to the galactic. And for that to happen by random accident would be unbelievable. And then you look at the process of living, self-replicating living cell. Just a single cell would be probability beyond enormous. Multicell would be probability to the next quantum. Well, then what if you had a multi-cell, self-replicating organism that was conscious? What's the probability of that? So I look at the universe, and I don't see how anybody that's educated could go, oh, just a random accident and life means nothing. No, our lives mean something, and part of our lives is to find and share truth. And that's what I've dedicated the balance of my life to, because I've been lied to my whole life about so many things that it's just really offensive.
What do you think happened with the Big Bang? How did it start, Joseph?
Actually, interestingly enough, I wrote 10 articles on that at Canada Free Press, beginning with Big Bang Rebuttal, which was listing higher than Stephen Hawking's book with the same name.
Well, really good for you.
And then I followed it with an article called Cosmology's Peptic Ulcer. And at Canada Free Press, I had 40 to 50,000 readers a week. So I was getting dozens of comments on my email address, and it was like one of these guys, I managed to find an article where they interviewed Edwin Hubble, Time Magazine, December 14th, 1936.
Who the telescope was named after, right?
The telescope was named after, and he was called the father of Big Bang because he discovered, quote, the redshift. And he said it was a hoax, but he was using the 100-inch Hooker telescope at Mount Palomar, but he was trying to get funding for a 200-inch. He said, at this time, we're showing the edge of the universe is 3 billion light years away, and it's moving away from us at 25,000 miles per second, which is pretty unbelievable. He said, but if we had a 200-inch telescope, double the diameter would give you four times the light-absorbing power, and we'll be able to see back 13 billion years, and at that point, light will be moving 100,000, I mean, the light from those distant galaxies will be moving 100,000 miles per second. That's more than half of the speed of light. Well, what energy force could possibly be pushing entire galaxies at that speed? It's absurd. So this bothered me back when I was taking freshman courses in physics in college, and it was like, you know, I remember sitting in elementary school, and every Friday we had the air raid drills, and they had a siren right there behind our elementary school, and the thing would go around in a circle, and you get Doppler shift with rotation the same way you do with linear. So you got a train goes by, it's go, you get the sound shift. Same thing with this siren. It'd be, and you could tell which direction the horn was facing.
Just by the sound of it.
So I thought, well, I'll write an article about that. So I wrote, Mysterious Dr. X Says Universe Is Not Expanding, because that's what Hubble said in 1936. I got a reader in Germany, said, Olson, you need to check out the Einstein-Gödel matrix. And I went, he said, this has already been discussed. And I went, oh, crap, I've embarrassed myself in front of the world by writing an article on something that was already discussed and dismissed. So I dug it up. Turns out Einstein was teaching at Princeton. He wasn't that good in math, and so he had a guy named Gödel who was an absolute genius.
Einstein wasn't good in math, really?
No, he really wasn't. No, that's incredible. But he had a guy there at Princeton, and he said, you know, I took your field equations, and I figured out that I can solve your field equations if we have these three variables. And one of them is the spin of cosmic dust, which we'll find out when we get the cosmic background radiation, and the other is, now what were those three variables? I wasn't expecting to get off in this, and so it's not exactly on my train of thought, but it's in an article that I wrote called Federally Funded Frankenscience.
Well, I got to ask you this. At what point will we have the technology where we can see the beginning of the universe? I mean, we go back billions of years now, but we're not quite there yet. When can we get there?
Well, if you actually follow the Einstein-Gödel rotational model, the universe is not expanding at all, and it's probably not as big, and probably it's curved. And so what we're looking out and seeing is the backside of what we are. And so we're actually looking around. Light travels in a curved path, and so when you're looking out, all you're seeing is you know, a house of mirrors of your own behind.
So we can't see where it began.
No, it probably didn't happen that way at all. And here's the thing that's really puzzling about this. The Einstein-Gödel model was proposed in 1949, the same year that they got the Mount Palomar 200-inch telescope operational. At which point, you know, we were proven that it wasn't going to work. And I'm convinced that the CIA came over and knocked on the door and said, ixnay on this, because part of your Einstein-Gödel model is if the universe is rotational, then time travel is axiomatic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not time travel in the sense that you can go back and alter time. It's only that if you have the proper equipment, you can go back and see what happened, which means that every crime in the universe would be knowable.
We would be witnesses to everything.
We're all leaving carbon footprints on our life here on this planet, and it's all discoverable. And that's what the CIA, I'm sure, was worried about. And what they needed in order to do that is they needed to find the spin of cosmic dust. They needed to have dust from the moon would be a perfect way to find out what the dust was in the universe. So that was one of the working hypotheses back when I still kind of believed Apollo, which we didn't get a chance to jump into, and I'd like to do
that. We're going to do that at the end. We'll do that at the end of the show.
Okay, good. Super, super, super. Yeah, it went to take 5 minutes. Okay, next caller.
Let's get a quick call here out of Carl in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Hi, Carl. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Okay.
Hey, I wanted to talk with Joe, and, thank you for taking my call, all that crap.
Of course.
But don't you think with all the global warming, it kind of all bases on just human arrogance. Just the idea that humans think that they can change the planet just in a few short 100, or not even 100,000 years, maybe 25,000 years of industrial stuff.
I think arrogance may have a little bit to do with it, but money has a lot to do with it. Joe?
Well, we've already discussed this, the power of uranium. We have the capability to completely turn this planet into a cinder. And we also have the capability with glyphosate and 5G and genetically modified crops. We have the ability to make this place completely inhospitable. Chemtrails, you know.
Well, they're working on it then. They're getting there.
Oh, yeah. There's people that I'm convinced the people at the top of the pyramid are demonic, and they hate life and they hate what God's created for us, and they don't want us to be able to progress as a human society. And they're more than willing to. They've already stated that the maximum carrying capacity of Earth is 600,000 people, and they stated that back in 1900. That was one of the things that cemented the Iranians.
Well, we're about 7 billion over their numbers, then, aren't we?
Well, that means they got to kill 90% of the people on the planet. I'm sorry, I ain't going down without a fight.
Good. So. I'll be standing with you. I'll be standing with you, but you know, it's frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'll tell you something else. And when we had our last conversation in June of 2017, and your subscribers need to go back and listen to that, we talked about patent theft. And,
right.
And this is where these people enrich themselves by stealing ideas. And we had talked about Antonio Meucci invented the telephone, submitted his patents in 1860, and they weren't used until 1876. Well, there wasn't enough generating capacity, and there wasn't enough telegraph line to make it monetarily possible. But when there was, they sent Alexander Graham Bell over to figure out what he was doing. And then 6 months later, Bell stole the patents. And Rockefeller created the American telephone and telegraph monopoly.
And they ran with it. Stay with us, Joe. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll take some more final calls, and then we'll get into your thoughts about the Apollo moon landings. And I'm really interested in getting your take on all of that. Back in a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Joseph Olson with us. We'll take a few more calls, and then we'll get into his thoughts toward the end of the show about the Apollo landings. Let's go to Gordon in Plant City, California. Hey, Gordy, go ahead.
Actually, it's Florida, but that's okay. Hey, listen, I have a theory, and I want to run it by you, that the global warming is not caused by the CO2, but rather the CO2 is caused by the global
Slow down, Gordon. Slow down now.
Okay. In other words, that it's backwards. I've looked at graphs, and basically that the global warming is caused by ozone decreases in the ozone layer, and in turn causes the increase in CO2. And also that something that you did not mention, but it's very important, is that the amount of CO2 is not only very small, which, I mean, you have a small amount of iron in your body, but the amount that we change is very small. We can only change a little tiny bit. So, I want you to address that point as well. In all fairness, you only have a little tiny bit of iron, and too much of that can make you sick. But I'm going to stay on the line because you might want to ask me to clarify it. So go ahead.
You'll stay on the line if I let you. Go ahead. Go ahead, Joe.
No problemo. First of all, I've heard the ozone is the one that's causing the ozone depletion is the one that's causing the variation in temperature. Timothy Casey at geologist-1011 has a very interesting article called Volcanic Halocarbon. Fluorine is the 16th most common element on the planet, and it combines with it's very reactive, combines with hundreds and hundreds, and it creates thousands of natural compounds, and it's being expelled by volcanic gases along those rift lines and out of volcanoes constantly, and it gobbles up far more ozone. But let's get back to where does ozone come from? It comes from ionized oxygen from lightning.
From lightning?
Lightning, and there's hundreds of lightning strikes per second.
Does lightning generate that much?
Yes, and ozone is highly reactive. It's a fairly unstable, it's highly reactive. It's great if you want to kill bacteria. You put ozone in there, boom, kills them dead. They use ozonated water in Paris since 1900, and it's used by over 2,000 cities worldwide because ozone is safer than chlorine. And it's highly reactive. It only has a half-life of about 30 to 40 minutes. So the planet's constantly producing ozone. Ozone's constantly being reduced, and whatever's happened in the upper atmosphere is minuscule. They claim that ground-level ozone is a pollution. Well, guess what? Ground-level ozone absorbs the same dangerous UV rays that troposcopic ozone absorbs. So why are they coming around beating us with that? Because the patents on Freon had run out, and they needed to get renewed patents in order to continue to rip us off with the DuPont and Dow Chemical patent theft.
First-time caller,
exactly what it was.
Gio in New Orleans is with us. Hi, Gio. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Have you spoken about why you believe we didn't go to the moon yet?
We're going to do that, Gio, right at the end, so you just stand by for that. We will get into that indeed. I'm a little interested in that myself. Let's go to Daniel in New Jersey. Go for it. Daniel, hi.
Hi, George. Hi, Joseph.
Hi.
Hi, sir. With all due respect, I do have to disagree with Joseph on the matter of the greenhouse effect. And I use the planets Venus and Mercury as my example.
Okay. And the floor is yours, Daniel. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. So my point is that Mercury is the closest planet to the sun, and it is not the hottest planet. Venus is the hottest planet, and despite the fact that it's over 30 million miles further from the sun than Mercury, and the biggest difference is that Venus has an atmosphere of about 97% carbon dioxide, and Mercury cannot support an atmosphere because it's too close to the sun, and the solar radiation will just destroy whatever sort of atmosphere that it could possibly have.
The atmosphere of Venus is like 900 miles thick, and it's made of sulfuric acid and carbon dioxide, and we have not landed a probe on there to actually verify what the surface conditions are of Venus. Most likely, Venus has a volcanic core just like Earth does, and so they're well insulated. Any mass between a heat source and a heat sink is going to slow down heat transfer. And so if Venus has even a fraction of the internal uranium and thorium that Earth has, then it would have a heat generator, and then it has a super thick atmosphere that would slow down the heat and it would drive the temperature up. So that's a non-starter. Mercury has no atmosphere, and it's trivial. It's not even worth discussing as far as greenhouse gas. That is one of the most ridiculous canards ever put forward by the warmest community.
Joe in Santa Rosa, California is with us, west of the Rockies. Hey, Joseph, go ahead, sir.
Hi, George and Joseph.
Hi there.
I was wondering, have you ever read the article about the massive flood in California in 1861-62? Where there was a half a dozen pineapple expresses from the Columbia River all the way down to San Diego, and Los Angeles got 60 inches of rain.
Wow.
And this was 1861-62. And before the massive rains in December, they had a massive snow buildup in the Cascades and Sierra Nevada. And with the warm rain falling down, Sacramento was close to 30 feet underwater. They had the buildup, Old Town Sacramento, close to 20, 25 feet. Leon Stanford was elected governor. He had to row a boat to the state capital.
Oh, jeez.
And then they had to move the state capital of San Francisco for half a year.
Well, Joe, so we did have huge climate issues in those days.
Yeah, the inconvenient truth is that you have to be able to really narrow your field of vision in order to believe this goofy hypothesis. Yeah, because the planet, we live in a universe that is profoundly indifferent to human existence. And we've been able to survive and flourish on this planet because we network together and we help each other solve problems that individually would be completely impossible to solve. And so the human collective over the period of time has done enormous amount to overcome obstacles, natural obstacles that otherwise would have just destroyed us. And so, yes, they claim that we've had the worst flood in the history of the United States during Hurricane Harvey. Well, actually not. That would be read Rising Tide by John M. Barry. In 1927, they had record snowfall all across the upper portion of the United States, which the Mississippi River drains one-third of the area of the United States through the Ohio, Mississippi, and Missouri rivers. They were already at flood stage on April 15th, which was Easter Sunday. 6 weeks later, a tropical storm pulled in over New Orleans, and they flooded 27,000 square miles with an average depth of 10 feet. Killed over 10,000 people, making it worse than the hurricane disaster in 1900 in Galveston. But you've never heard about it because it's inconvenient to talk about that. And the interesting thing is, if you've got 200 years of record and you have a massive flood, that's a 100-year flood. It could happen again tomorrow.
Absolutely. I witnessed a 500-year flood in 1993 here in St. Louis, and it was freaky.
Look at what's happening to the Midwest right now. And then we just had this tropical storm that came in across New Orleans. Well, we built a better levee system than before, but those levees are at the breaking point.
We're going to take...
We could end up having...
Go ahead. No, you finish up.
We could have that event again, and so it could end up being a 50-year flood.
That's right. Absolutely. We're going to take final calls after we talk with Joseph now about why he doesn't think, he's a little skeptical of why we landed astronauts on the moon. Joseph, tell me what's going on here.
Okay, first of all, we've already discussed the equatorial temperature change on the moon as being minus 270 degrees Fahrenheit to 242 degrees Fahrenheit, and that cycle takes less than 36 hours. There's an article at the Journal of Geophysical Research called Lunar Equator Surface Temperature and Regolith Profile, and it said that the sun only penetrates 0.4 meters in depth. So 14 days of sunshine, the surface of the moon is like refractory brick. Well, guess what? One of the co-authors of Slaying the Sky Dragon is Dr. Martin Hertzberg, who has a PhD in physical chemistry from Stanford, is a former U.S. Navy meteorologist, Fulbright scholarship, and he owns two patents, one on submicron particle detectors and the other one on multi-channel infrared barometers that you could use to measure temperature inside blast ovens that melted every other type of temperature probe that you had. Those technologies are used by NASA satellites to verify the temperature on the SOHO satellite. So this is one of my co-authors at Slaying the Sky Dragon, is his technology is being used on the moon. Okay, so if you have a temperature profile, what's the chances that you're going to be able to land on the moon in that narrow little degree of 500 degree Fahrenheit temperature variation where a human being could actually survive? Now, I've written an article on this called Perplexing Apollo Questions for NASA, and it's at my Folk Science Slayer website.
The next obstacle that I have with them is the amount of fuel that was on the Saturn rocket system. Stage one had 318,000 gallons of liquid oxygen and 203 gallons of kerosene. That lifted the assembly up to 42 miles altitude with a speed of 5,330 miles. The second stage had 340,000 gallons of fuel, lifted it up to 115 miles above Earth with a speed of 15,300 miles per hour. Okay, the third stage supposedly boosted the thing to 24,000 miles, but the third stage only had 66,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen and 19,000 gallons of liquid oxygen.
But what are you saying?
That's all the fuel you had to get you 240,000 miles to the moon, circle the moon, land the lander on the moon, have the lander take off from the moon, and then bring the command module back to the Earth. And, you know, I've had, I explained this to my across the street neighbor, which is always nice to bounce things off of, other people's heads and see where they're at. And it's like, no, there's no gravity in space. I go, whoa, contraire, senor. There's plenty of gravity in space. The only thing that keeps the Earth from falling into the sun or spinning off into outer universe is that the Earth has a forward velocity circling the sun at 91 million miles of 67,000 miles per hour. The moon circles the Earth at 2,288 miles per hour. If you have a geosynchronous orbited satellite, it's at 22,000 miles above Earth with a 6,800 mile per hour velocity. The space station at 240 miles above the Earth has a forward velocity of 17,500 miles per hour. It's just like the vomit comet that they use for astronaut training. You go up and you fly over the parabola, and as the plane's dropping at the same speed of gravity, 32 feet per second.
So, Joe, are you saying that they faked all of these?
Well, you know, I hate to say it. I really do. This is probably the one science thing that broke my heart the most. But then you look on my article, you look at the Apollo command module. That thing's the size of my Sienna minivan. It has no docking mechanisms, and it has no airlocks. So that means the astronauts are sitting inside this command module. They open the door. All the air goes out. Two astronauts jump out, and it underneath them, between them and the lander, is the rocket engine. So what do they do? Spacewalk over to the lander? And then there's no fuel on the lander to keep it from crashing into the moon. There's no fuel on the lander to make it take off from the moon. And when you get back up to the command module, you have to spacewalk from the lander back into the command module.
You're talking about the LEM, right?
Yes. And read my article and just remain skeptical on it.
I'll always still believe we went to the moon with all those astronauts.
Well, I wish it was true. I wish I could.
I would love for you to. God, I wish Edgar Mitchell were still alive, Apollo 14. I'd love for you to talk with him and ask him those questions about the fuel and about the heat and the cold on the sun and stuff, just to see what he would have said.
Okay.
If you do Buzz Aldrin, he may take a swing at you.
He took a swing at Bart.
Well, I know. Bart kept saying, swear on this Bible. And Aldrin just didn't want anything
George,
to do with that.
Where does the time go? I'm looking at my clock.
I know. This is it. We've got a minute left, my friend, and then we are done. Where do people get your book, Slaying the Sky Dragon?
It's available on Amazon, which I don't promote, but it's also available at Stairway Press. So you can go directly to the publisher and get copies of that. And then go to my website, Faux Science Slayer. I've got a wide variety. I write articles on satire and a lot of articles on history because they've lied to us about so much of that.
Do you take emails through your website, by the way?
No, I don't, because I just get overwhelmed with them. You know, I spend 8 or 10 hours a day researching and then, you know, a couple of hours a week writing. And when I was at Canada Free Press, I was getting dozens of comments every day, and I was getting dozens of Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn requests, And I just can't play patty cake with everybody on the planet.
No, I understand. Joseph, thanks for being on the program. Very compelling about climate change, indeed. In terms of the moon, I still think we went. But you have your opinion, and we have ours. I'm going to come back in a moment as we talk about the occult with Mitch Horowitz on Coast to Coast AM.